Yeah, so superconductivity was discovered in strontium ruthenate actually in 1994 by Yoshi Miyano. So this is an area that has, you know, a fair history, and there's been a lot of important work done, both theory and experiment, whereas I actually only got involved in this area about six months ago when I was visiting Stanford because I learned that there were new results from Kapitulnik's group which were being interpreted in terms of firm evidence for chiral P-wave superconductivity. And at the same time, John Kirtley was also visiting Stanford, where he had new unpublished results that were basically null results. That is, he wasn't seeing a signal expected for a chiral P-wave superconductor. And it turned out that Catherine Moeller's group, also at Stanford, had recently published results similar to Kirtley's, actually, that were also null results. So I got involved with Kirtley and Cam in trying to understand the results and how to reconcile this. And as part of that exercise, I went back and, because I hadn't really followed this field, looked back at all the experiments that were taken as evidence for chiral P-wave superconductivity. And I have to say my own point of view is that there is really no real evidence for chiral P-wave superconductivity. Although I should say that this is controversial. I know when I talk to experimentalists that have published results that they take as positive signatures, they feel quite strongly the other way. So I'm actually hoping that perhaps there's a few people here that have followed the field a bit over the course of the years, and so I'm actually looking for arguments and disagreement with some of the interpretations and points I'm going to make. So we'll see. So here's an outline. I'm just going to give a very brief introduction to P plus IP superconductivity, just emphasizing the few things that I need in order to talk about the various experiments. For any of you that were here, Victor gave a very nice general talk about P plus IP. So if you were there, you don't need this brief introduction, but otherwise it's there. And then I'll say a bit about the very early evidence pointing towards P plus IP, and then move on to the more recent experiments and end with putting this all together and where I think we are at. So here's this very brief introduction. First of all, if you have a P-wave superconductor, that means you must have triplet pairing because the whole wave function has to be anti-symmetric. And triplet superconductivity, the gap function is usually described as a 2x2 matrix. That isn't important for anything I'm going to say. What's important is that they describe it in terms of a so-called D vector, which tells you first about the spin orientation of this triplet. It says that the component of the spin along D is zero. So here, writing this D is in the Z direction means that SZ is zero in this triplet configuration. And furthermore, in strontium ruthenate, it's believed that there's a strong spin orbit coupling that orients the D vector along the C axis. So I should have said strontium ruthenate is a layered material with all the electronic action in the strontium oxide layers that say are the AB direction. I'm going to call that the XY plane, and then the C axis is perpendicular, and we'll call that the Z direction. So this is the orientation of your D vector, say, along the C axis or Z axis, and SZ equals zero can also be represented if you quantize it in along an axis in the AB plane. It can be described as equal spin pairing in the plane, with no component along Z. And then the important orbital information is contained for, what's proposed for strontium ruthenate is this chiral P-wave order parameter that has this complex nature, kx plus or minus iky, where the plus and minus sign refer to two chiralities there corresponding to an angular momentum plus one or minus one for the Cooper pair. And these two chiralities are degenerate, which means, in principle, in a macroscopic sample, you can have domains where some regions maybe have one chirality and there's a domain wall to regions with the other chirality. Although these domain walls cost you energy, so in an ideal situation, you would not have domains and the system would just pick out one chirality. This is a two component order parameter, you know, there's a delta X and a delta Y component. So I'm just introducing here some notation I'm going to use on the next slide following Segrist's paper, where just write this as the magnitude of the gap function, say in the uniform case, times these two components U and V. So in the uniform case, say U would just be 1 and V would be plus or minus I. Okay. Now, because of this, well, first of all, because of the P wave nature of this order parameter, it turns out that defects in surfaces are pair breaking. They always pair break one of the components or one linear combination of the two components, no matter what direction they're in. And this causes supercurrents to flow at surfaces, defects, or domain walls due to the spatial variation of the two component order parameter. And perhaps the easiest way to see this is from the Ginzburg-Landau free energy, where I'm just going to focus on a couple terms here. I mean, you may recognize, you have the usual quadratic terms, quartic terms, except there's two components here. But because you have the two components, what's sort of new in the Ginzburg-Landau free energy is you get these so-called mixed gradient terms that are allowed by symmetry, where you see it involves derivatives both in the x direction and the y direction of the two components. And this means that if you perturb the system in one direction, say by having a surface, I don't know what happened to my line here, but there's supposed to be a vertical line here at x equals 0. That's, I see some of the lines disappeared there. Anyways, that if there's a surface here at x equals 0, that's perturbing the system in the x direction. But because of this mixed gradient term, that can cause a current in the y direction. Which you can see from the expression for the current in the y direction. But you can also understand this, that if you have a surface in the x at x equals 0 here, the momentum in the y direction is conserved. So in fact, delta y, which we're calling v, is unperturbed by such a surface, and to lowest order it would just be a constant. Whereas this surface is pair breaking for delta x because you have scattering processes where kx goes into minus kx. And so when x varies, when delta x varies in the x direction and v is non-zero, you see you get a current in the y direction. So in other words, because of these scattering processes, you get edge states that are localized within roughly the coherence length of the edge, and they carry a current. Yes?
Just the previous one more back.
Okay, one more back, yeah.
So this is a layer system,
It's two-dimensional. Yeah, the superconductivity may not be as two-dimensional as the coupe rates, because they say there's a coherence length that's actually several lattice spacings in that direction, but...
And D is a three-dimensional vector, so in principle it's a 3x2 matrix. In the Hilbert case, we talk about 3x3 complex.
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, that's right. I think of this as a 2x2 matrix of vectors, of three-dimensional vectors, but you know, because that captures your triplet thing. But there's different ways of representing this. Yes.
Are there experimental evidence that the E vectors,
along the C axis? Yeah, so we'll get to that because NMR should have something to say about that. And it's one of these experiments that used to be cleaner and easier to interpret when there was less data. As we got more data, it became more confusing. But anyways, yeah, that's an important point. We'll get to that. Oh, is it? Yeah, I don't know. Okay.
So if you have these supercurrents caused by boundaries or maybe grain boundaries or
right.
whatever, twins or something, does that mean that induces vortices?
That it induces vortices?
Yeah.
It can, under certain geometries, in that you can trap vortices at these, but it's not necessary. Because actually, as I'm going to make the point... Well, okay, so that, I think you're getting to a very important point. A superconductor does not want any magnetic fields inside it, right? And so far I've talked about that. There's a supercurrent along this edge. There's also a screening current, which will be exactly equal and opposite but that's confined to the penetration depth rather than the coherence length, right, because it's the screening response. And so you always have zero field inside the bulk superconductor, and you have counter-flowing currents around edges and boundaries and that. So any magnetization or magnetic field is localized to defects, domain walls, edges, and there's no magnetic field inside the superconductor.
Okay, so it's obvious then that the field you set up is below HC1.
No, it doesn't have to be below HC1 because, you know, you can have a field above HC1 penetrating within a penetration depth of the surface, right? You know, the fields aren't necessarily below HC1.
I just wonder if the particular boundary sets have a big enough field, then you might think it would induce vortices in the opposite direction.
Yeah, but you see, you know, all of this is happening in the surface layer. Well, and actually, probably the magnitude of these actually do stay below HC1, I guess, because although they're not that small, they generate things of the order of 10 Gauss or so. I believe HC1 is a bit higher than that. Okay, so actually, you know, what I painted on the last transparency was sort of the simple zero order result of an edge. There's been self-consistent Biglibov-Degen calculations by Sigrist and co-workers where I just show the results here that if you do things self-consistently, as I said, the X order parameter is suppressed, the surface is pair-breaking, but the Y order parameter actually increases a bit because this is what always happens when you have a two-component order parameter. If you suppress one, the other one can grow then and save some condensation energy. And so because of these variations in the order parameter, there's a current that flows at the boundary roughly in something of the order of the coherence length, but then there's a screening current that's equal in offset and magnitude that's confined over that coherence length plus the penetration depth. And these alternating currents at the surface give rise to a local magnetic field also confined roughly to within the penetration depth. And these are the fields that I was saying at a boundary, this actually for strontium ruthenate parameters, this should be of the order of 10 Gauss. So it's not that small of a field. It turns out if you look at a domain wall, that calculation is very similar to just putting two edges together. And you get a field on each side of the domain wall, which alternates in sign on the two sides. You get a current that flows down the domain wall with compensating currents on each side. And in that case, the maximum field is more like 20 Gauss because it's sort of like two edges stuck together. So this is a prediction from chiral P wave, which is actually very robust. I mean, you know, the numbers may change depending on the details in that, but these currents are basically allowed by symmetry. And in fact, if you understand, you know, the symmetry of the order parameters, it would be quite it's hard to imagine how they could vanish. I mean, that would be a very accidental vanishing of special choices of parameters.
So the surface is on a line
direction. Yes. Yes. Yeah.
So if you live in an edge but just some weaker perturbation, do you get a current that's proportionately, well, not proportionally, but smaller?
Well, it depends. It depends whether your perturbation is such that it's really causing the order parameter to go to one of the components to go to zero, right? Because you can imagine perturbations that just weaken one of the order parameters, and then you'll get a smaller local field. But basically, any time in this two-component chiral order parameter, any time you cause any perturbation that causes the order parameter to vary spatially, you're going to have supercurrents. And hence you'll have local magnetizations.
Does this sense the current reverse if you had something that locally enhanced?
If you what?
I mean, if the perturbation is either a repulsive potential or an attractive one, or somehow locally enhances or decreases the order parameter, does this sense the current reverse?
I mean, it's hard to enhance the order parameter noticeably locally, except through, you know, suppressing the other one, because, you know, because if you could do that, you know, you could make a better superconductor, right? So the primary thing that determines the direction of the local field net is whatever chirality of the domain you're in, right? Because these currents flow in opposite directions for the two chiralities. But, you know, if you take a sample that's a single chirality, and you look at, you know, so here you have X surfaces, Y surfaces, you know, there's currents that flow all the way around continuously, just determined by the chirality, even though a different order, different components being suppressed here than here. So it's really the chirality that, of course, you always have these counterflows too. Okay, so that's all I wanted to say sort of about, you know, the nature of the order parameter that's being proposed for strontium-ruthenate. So I want to actually move on to the experimental evidence, okay? So starting with the very early evidence, I think the first important point is that the transition temperature of superconductivity is extremely sensitive to disorder in strontium-ruthenate. You know, so in the best single crystals, they achieve a TC of about 1.5 Kelvin. And if you cause, you know, add any disorder to those crystals, TC quickly goes down. And that's a key signature of unconventional pairing, because for an S-wave superconductor, we have Anderson's theorem, non-magnetic scattering shouldn't affect TC. So I'd say that's very strong evidence that we have non-S-wave scattering in strontium-ruthenate. Of course, if you have S-wave scattering, then you must have singlet pairing, because the wave function has to be anti-symmetric. But if you have non-S-wave scattering, it opens up the question, do you have singlet or triplet pairing? Okay, so that's the first question. And that's usually addressed by NMR experiments that measure the night shift, which is basically a measurement of the spin susceptibility. So for a singlet superconductor, if you measure the spin susceptibility, it plummets as you go below TC, because basically, you know, you have a paramagnet in the normal state, and as you go below TC, you're losing magnetic moments or spins because they're condensing into singlets. You know, so their spins are disappearing, and so the spin susceptibility drops off. However, if you have a triplet superconductor, then you don't see this fall off if you have a triplet where the this is data on strontium-ruthenate where they've put a field in the plane. So the idea here is that as long as your triplet is described by S perpendicular to that field equals zero, that is, as long as your triplets, you have equal spin pairing in the direction of the field, then that's acting just like your paramagnet that had equal up and down spins in any direction, actually, because that was spin 1/2. And so you aren't losing spin susceptibility, and these dots here are actually a character of the data. This drop-off is what you would have expected for singlet pairing, and so this experiment was taken as key signature of triplet pairing. The fact that there was no drop-off in the spin susceptibility as you went through TC, and it was taken as a confirmation that the polarization of that triplet pairing was as expected, that is, that the D vector was along the C-axis direction, perpendicular to this. Now, let me just mention that the complication is that more recent data, this was data from 1998, just a few years ago, they managed to do the measurement with, these are very difficult measurements, turns out, with the field along the C-axis direction, and it also didn't fall off. So that's actually that's not compatible with the order parameter that's being proposed, at least not a priori. So I'll discuss that at the end. So that's how things got more complicated. But anyways, taking this is data for, you know, that is pointing towards triplet pairing. And if you have triplet pairing, you would think P wave should, you know, it means you have to have odd angular momentum, and P wave's the most likely, although in principle you could have F wave.
So you say this is the implant.
This is in plane, the field is in plane.
Which is consistent
with your triplets also being polarized in the plane, that is, with having no component perpendicular to that. Yeah. And that's, you know, where your D vector is the direction which you don't have.
The D is the inversion. If we use the C axis, we should expect
if you put a field in the c-axis direction, actually it should fall off. You know, because if you think of it, you know, you've got S, you're condensing into a state with SZ equals zero or SC equals zero. So you start with a paramagnetic state and you're losing spins that are condensing into SC equals zero. You should notice that. So the fact that they didn't see any decline in field along C is a problem. So actually, I might as well mention, so Segrist has a very clever idea about this, although it is a little bit complex, where he says that although the spin orbit is strong, he says that if you look at competing states, there's also just PX and PY admixtures that aren't chiral, that there's competing states that would have a D vector in the plane and a non-chiral ground state, and he thinks a small field might tilt the energy balance such that the system actually switches over from a chiral P-wave state to one of these non-chiral states. If that's true, you know, there should be experimental signatures of it.
So you'd have notes in the plane, wouldn't you?
No, because actually the state he's proposing has a D vector, you know, say along the X direction, or the D vector can lie anywhere in the plane, but it multiplies something like KX X hat plus KY Y hat. Oh, sorry, this is what I meant. The D vector actually has these components, KX X hat and KY Y hat.
So,
exactly. But it's not chiral, right? So this also has, that's why it's somewhat competitive in energy with the chiral P-wave state, because it's fully gapped in the plane but has a D vector lying in the plane. But you don't have any chirality.
It's similar to phase B of helium-3?
I'm not that familiar with helium-3, so I don't know. I just barely learned the helium A phase. Is it?
You mean this one?
But you see, for people really interested in quantum computing, these words should start to worry them. Because, you know, what quantum computing really likes is, first of all, to be right that it is a chiral P wave. Okay, it's too bad that the D vector got pinned along the C axis direction by spin orbit, but if somehow a field could tilt that D vector and let it freely rotate in the XY plane, and still preserve your chiral nature, that would be great for a quantum computer, right? Because that's where you would get all these Majorana fermions and non-abelian statistics and that. But see, what Segrist is proposing is that when you tilt the D vector, the most energetically favorable state is not chiral. You know, this is not going to have non-abelian statistics or anything like that. So, well, on the other hand, you know, the experiments still have a way to go to confirm any of this. This is just a possible interpretation. The anisotropy of the... No, you mean, like, in principle, they should be able to get at that kind of information by looking at collective modes, for example. You know, their frequency would tell you about that pinning and that. But, no, I'd say, you know, this NMR data, that, and I should say, this is actually the real data. You know, it turns out there's two inequivalent oxygen sites, so you get two inequivalent night shifts. But you see, the data's flat, right? I mean, this data and the newer data with the field in the opposite direction, you know, that's about it for information on this orientation of the D vector. And as I say, it's not so easy to interpret the new data because it's not completely consistent with any single order parameter, you know, is the trouble. It's as if the system is changing somehow. Yeah, that's amazing, isn't it? I don't know. Okay, well, you have to ask these. It's nature. What can you say, right? Yeah. Okay, so I now want to move on to a different experiment, MuSR, which is, because so far, you know, I've talked about an experiment which was evidence for triplet pairing, okay, and so that could point towards P-wave. But here's a measurement, an early measurement, also in 1998, that was taken as evidence for chiral P wave superconductivity. So it's a MuSR experiment where, let me just tell you a tiny bit about MuSR. You basically shoot in a beam of polarized muons and inject them into your sample. Their spins will precess in whatever local fields there are. They decay at some time, an average time of a few microseconds. And as they decay, they emit a positron, which preferentially shoots out in the direction of the spin, muon spin, at that instant in time when it decays. And so by measuring the time of decay and the asymmetry between, you know, the positron moving forward and backwards, analyzing this can give you information about the local fields. Because as it processes, obviously, you know, at some point in time, it's more likely to be pointing in this direction than that direction, et cetera. So one of the things you often see in materials is what's called a Kubo-Toyama line shape to this measured asymmetry as a function of time. This is what you get if there's a dense array of local moments, which is what you'd get from nuclear spins. And nuclear spins are always there, so you always expect to get some Kubo Toyama contribution to your line shape. And the important point here is that it starts off with some curvature at short times. So they did MuSR on strontium ruthenate in 1998, looking at it as a function of temperature. So above TC, they saw a curve where there is some curvature here. Turns out it's fit by this Kubo-Toyama form, plus there's some extra relaxation that can be fit by an exponential form. And as they go to lower temperatures, there's additional relaxation, which means that this lambda, the relaxation rate, is increasing as you go to lower temperatures. So to have this exponential form, that's what you expect when you have, remember, this K comes from a dense array of moments. The exponential form comes from a dilute distribution of fields. And so by studying this lambda of T, they could plot out the relaxation rate as a function of temperature. And basically, although there's not a lot of data here, the idea is that it's constant above TC, and you see that the relaxation increases much like the superconducting order parameter increases. And as this relaxation increases, that's a sign that the scale of your internal fields is increasing. So this is an idea that as you go into the superconducting state, you have spontaneous internal fields occurring that are increasing as you condense into the superconductor. So this is evidence for taken as evidence for time reversal symmetry breaking of the superconducting order parameter. So a few points here is they looked at both the muon spin initially polarized along C. So, you know, a spin will only precess around a field that's perpendicular to its spin. So this is really only measuring fields in the AB plane. And this is measuring fields that include components in the C-axis direction. Now, all these domain walls, edges I talked about, you know, they actually introduce fields perpendicular to the AB plane because you've got currents moving around in the AB plane. So this data was, if you read the paper, it's interpreted as evidence. First of all, in the bulk P plus IP superconductor, in principle, there's no internal fields, right? I said the superconductor doesn't like to have internal fields. When you shoot a muon in, you know, that's a charged particle. It causes a perturbation that affects the order parameter. And it should create its own local field. Okay, they saw no evidence for the muons creating, you know, an identical field for every muon. So they didn't see that. They saw this effect that is fit by assuming that you have a dilute array of internal fields, and they said that that was evidence for internal domain walls between the two chiralities, because you get, you know, you get field, if you have dilute domain walls, you'll get some dilute distribution of fields. The trouble with that picture is the fields should have been in the C-axis direction, and if you look at this data, you know, the fields are at least as large, if not larger, in the AB plane. So that's a problem.
Sorry, I was just going to ask about your thing you said about how the muon perturbs the system.
Right.
Is the picture that the muon then sets up some screening current because of its own magnetic field, and then it experiences that field back in its spin and sees something.
Yeah, well, it's that, you know, basically, so it's not so much, well, I guess there is the field there, but, you know, even just the charge of the muon causes a, a potential on the... And then there's a current set up. But
I mean, I think that, you know, that ideally, when you do MuSR, you don't think about the muon perturbing the system. You think of it as sensing whatever local fields happen to be there. Okay, now, I guess if you go to, you know, a meeting where there's a bunch of MuSR people and also anti-MuSR people, we were just at one in Toronto, this question of, well, whether the muon does perturb things and just completely change the physics always comes up. Actually, I guess all the MuSR people had their hands up when that criticism was raised, and that's not what they think.
Yeah, but of course, I mean, this order parameter, this, you know, if you have this P plus IP order parameter, you know, any potential perturbs it. That's, you know, it's because it's got two components. You know, anything that causes any kind of, you know, a static potential in either the x or y direction or any linear combination will affect one component of the order parameter. So I don't see any way around this. So it's problematic. They didn't see anything from the muons. It's problematic that they see at least as much field in the AB plane as to the C axis. And more generally, you know, this data is from 1998. You know, there's been very detailed calculations of what you expect from domain walls and that. I would say they should be able to, you know, take data that they actually analyze for the distribution of fields you expect around a domain wall, because basically here they got a characteristic field of 0.5 that they fit with the Lorentzian, which basically went up to infinite fields, fell off with a power law of weak fields, whereas, you know, a superconductor, you know, things fall off exponentially away from the domain walls or the surfaces. You know, you don't have any power law fall off of fields. The fields don't go up indefinitely, and they have a characteristic shape. So, you know, my message would be we should get better, you know, we should get more detailed MuSR data that we analyze in terms of the existing theory.
Data looks so bad in the sense that there are error bars on, you know, the points are far off any regular curve.
Whereas the lower one looks better for some reason.
The lower one looks pretty regular.
Yeah. I don't know what to say about that. Of course, this lower one, they don't give any information about the, you know, they just say that polarization is perpendicular to C. So in principle, you know, that's measuring fields in some CA or CB plane or some, you know, one such plane. So it's not just C-axis fields. So there should be some overlap of the fields in these two cases is all I'm saying. But, yeah, I don't know what to say about that scatter, except that it doesn't look atypical for MuSR data I've seen. What do you say?
I mean, the size of the error bar is just how long you measure, right?
Yeah. Well, you see, to actually even draw these curves, you know, they're sort of, they're assuming a Lorentzian shape to the field distribution. Well, you know, probably the actual fields that are being sampled are not a Lorentzian, you know, but this was the best model to fit the data. So right away, that's going to give you scatter. And that's why I say, you know, you could try and model it by the actual field distributions we expect. Okay.
Do the fields go in homogeneously? They tend to end up with more close to the surfaces.
Well, not the surfaces, and that they, you know, it's considered a bulk. Well, these are fast muons; they go into the bulk. But yeah, no, muons do tend to stop preferentially sometimes. You know, like, you know, next to, I don't know whether they like oxygen. So, you know, there are some symmetry sites that they may be more likely to stop near in the crystal than other ones. But. Yeah, so actually at this Toronto meeting, I just had a long chat with Yoshi Miano, because, of course, he's on most of the papers for positive evidence for P plus IP, so it was very interesting discussing with him, and I was giving him my spiel about how this MuSR was not at all convincing, and he was telling me about all this unpublished MuSR work So this is the only published MuSR work that that either of us were aware of. But he says there's unpublished work that studied impurities. It sounds like it's a bit of a mixed message, which is maybe why it's unpublished. One message I'd like to send out is an encouragement to publish null results, or results that don't happen to agree with the theory that people are connected to at the moment. Because I guess they said that basically this relaxation rate increased as you increase the number of impurities, saying that there was larger and larger fields as you increase the number of impurities. And actually, you should be changing the distribution. That is, you're more likely to sample the finite fields as you increase the number of impurities. But the strength of the fields, there's no reason why if you just double the number of impurities that you're seeing twice as large fields, right? Because each impurity sets up a local field, which is just determined by, the nature of the impurity. You add twice as many of them, you get the same magnitude of fields, you just get it in more places. So from just word of mouth, it sounds like the information on impurities is also not easy to understand in light of this model. But it'd be nice to see published work. Okay, so here's a measurement that actually I'm not going to say much about because I actually agree with the interpretation, or at least I see no problem with it. I wanted to focus more on the things that are a little bit more problematic to get some discussion going. But so let me just, it take a little bit of time to explain this in detail, but let me just say these were the first real phase-sensitive measurements done. So they're actually not testing for chirality. They're testing for parity of the order parameter. They're checking to see whether you have P wave, possibly F wave. They're checking for odd parity and trying to rule out S wave and D wave superconductivity. So it's basically making two junctions here, just some junctions between an S wave superconductor and your strontium ruthenate. And you apply a field so that you can look at an interference pattern from these two junctions. And although it's not obvious that you should have any low order tunneling from an S wave superconductor to, or from a singlet superconductor to a triplet superconductor, it turns out in the presence of spin orbit coupling, it's been shown that you can get an interference pattern and through a low order process. And let me just tell you, the bottom line here was that if you had an odd parity superconductor, like a P or F wave superconductor, then in this geometry that I just showed here, this is what's called this Geschenbaum, Larkin, Barone geometry, you expect an extra pi shift due to the odd parity of your order parameter relative to what they call the same side geometry, where your junction, where the two junctions are on the same side of your sample, there would be no minus sign. Yep. The previous one? Okay, so because this is an insulating layer, and this is all S-wave superconductor, it's all laid on top, So this is S-wave superconductor on top of this big block of strontium ruthenate, and here's your junction, here's your other junction. Okay, so they're on opposite sides, whereas the other one, you do everything on this face, a junction here and a junction here, same side geometry. And it really, so what you expect to see if you had an odd parity superconductor is that in one case you would see in the same side junction it would look like an S wave where you have a maximum in your oscillations at zero field. And in the opposite side geometry, if you had S wave, you'd also see a maximum, but if you have an odd parity superconductor, you'd see a minimum at zero field. Now, it's always complicated because there's all sorts of things that shift around the spectra, and so the experimentalists have to correct for an induced flux, so your zero field isn't really your external zero field. And they've drawn lines here where they say the effective zero field is, and if you look at them, this basically looks more or less like it's going through a maximum, and this looks like it's going through a minimum here. So that's taken as evidence for an odd parity superconductor. And given the ambiguities you always get in these phase-sensitive experiments, that they're very sensitive to everything, trapped flux and all that. But the one thing I would like to point out is, this is under the assumption, the reason you get this minus sign is because, you're assuming there's a single domain, and that there's actually a phase change here going from the plus lobe, if you like, to the minus lobe of the P wave. There could be, if you had one domain wall, that would mess this up. If you had two domain walls, that'd be okay. But, you know, so, you know, you either have a single domain or an odd number of domains, and it actually should be a small number of odd number of domains, because if you have domains, you know, this way, you have domains that way, and your signal is going to get wiped out as you average over too many domains. Okay, so that's something to keep in mind, because a lot of the experiments are compatible with P plus IP if you assume there's a whole bunch of domains around. Here's one that tried to, you know, that's more or less compatible with not having domains around.
You might think if you ended up and called it there in VTC,
that you could get rid of domain walls?
Or seeing a reproducible.
Yeah, so, you know, I talked to these authors, although the details aren't given in this paper, they say that, you know, they actually worked to get a single domain. That is, that they didn't always see this signal, that it helped to cool really slowly, although when you think of how big the fluctuation regime is, I don't know, you know, cooling slowly is over a very tiny temperature range, but and that it helped to cool in the field, although you have to be careful because, you know, these materials trap flux like crazy, right? So you start cooling in a field and you also get a whole bunch of trapped vortices in there that can affect these phase-sensitive experiments, but that's their story, that they think it's not. Also, you know, domain walls do cost you energy. So in principle, you know, it might, you know, it's only through the dynamics of cooling and defects which, you know, pin them that you expect to have any domain walls. You know, so you should be able to reduce them at least. Yeah. Okay, so here's a different, now we're getting into the really recent data, sort of in the last, 8 months or so. This is the data from Kapitulnik's group at Stanford on the so-called polar Kerr effect that's also taken as evidence for broken time reversal symmetry in the superinducting state, just like the MuSR data. So actually, although his particular experimental setup is a lot more complicated with fancy optics and that, the easiest way to understand this experiment is to say that, you know, basically you're shining incident light on your sample that is polarized in a certain direction, and looking at the reflected light that comes off and seeing if there's any rotation in the polarization angle of the reflected light compared to the incident light. Because if there is, that means it's decided to rotate either in a clockwise or anti-clockwise sense. And if you think about it, you know, that will only happen if you have something that actually has a chirality that is actually distinguishing between rotating in the clockwise or anti-clockwise sense. And then, so that's broken time reversal symmetry. So this is an effect that you always see in ferromagnets, because they have broken time reversal symmetry and they'll rotate in the direction corresponding to their magnetization. First of all, I should just say the small angle of rotation you see, one can show that this is proportional to the imaginary part of the Hall conductivity. And, of course, you don't expect a Hall conductivity unless you have something like an effective magnetic field or some time reversal symmetry breaking in your system. And it's done at optical frequency, so that's much larger than the gap frequency. This is a high-frequency measurement. And what Kapitulnik saw is that he saw a Kerr rotation, as if there's local moments or fields in the sample. This Kerr rotation only turned on at TC, and you can see it sort of grows with the superinducting order parameter. And what he's showing here are two different runs of the sample, one cooled in a field of plus 93 Gauss and one cooled in a field of minus 43 Gauss. And what's relevant here is that the saturation or the magnitude of this Kerr rotation is the same in magnitude, even though these fields differ by more than a factor of two, but the sign changes. So he interprets this that as you feel cooled, you can actually flip the chirality of your sample. His beam size is 25 microns across, so he needs, since he sees this kind of magnitude in most of his runs, he concludes that his domains on average are bigger than that size. Okay, although he occasionally sees something that has a reduced magnitude, so not too much bigger, he concludes that his domains are of the order of 50 to 100 microns across.
So when he moves his beam from one part of the sample
to the other. Has he ever seen a change of the sign of the signal?
Doesn't mention that in his paper, so I don't know about that.
It would take a long time. So, I mean, doing that would be like just taking a different measure.
That's like different one.
Yeah, so you probably, I mean, probably his different cooldowns and all that may actually be in different parts of the sample. Well, it depends how he runs it and that, but I don't know. And he also, in some small number of zero field cooled runs, saw the same magnitude. So, you know, suggesting that, you know, you just not, you know, that, well, and I should say, you know, it's, see these two dark data points? These are actually data points taken before he turned the field off. So this is basically making the claim that the fields of, you know, of about 100 Gauss are actually too small to themselves directly affect the Kerr angle, because you notice nothing changes before and after he turns the field off, although you do have to worry about flux trapping, and that, and he argues that trapped flux can't possibly account for the magnitude of the signal. You know, so he's saying that, you know, the signal has nothing to do with the, you know, the field that it was cooled in, and that it's something intrinsic to the superconductivity.
How does he argue that the trapped flux
can't? Yeah, so in his paper, I mean, maybe he has I meant to talk to him in person about this, because it's a little bit confusing, but when he said, you know, you take the magnitude of this signal in the field, like this 100 Gauss, and it turns out, you know, first of all, how many vortices do you have? How many flux quantum do you have in this 25 micron beam at 100 Gauss? He says that's about 3,000 vortices. Okay, so then you take your signal and divide it by 3,000, and that gives you a maximum estimate of what a single vortex can contribute. And it's way, you know, it's a couple orders of magnitude below his sensitivity signal. And he's saying that he sees this even in zero field, you know, where there can't be more than a few vortices around. And so he's got this magnitude that you can't possibly attribute to vortices in that case. And it's the same magnitude when there's lots of vortices around, and hence, you know, this must be due to an intrinsic property.
And if you had some distribution of, I mean, so the vortices being uniformly distributed, but as they were plus-semi-new earth fluctuations, you still can do that.
Well, you mean like if they were actually spatially clustered?
Lumps, I mean, just through pinning fluctuating or whatever.
Well, yeah, so that's sort of interesting. Yeah, what do you get for the Kerr rotation if you had very strong but localized fields only over a tiny fraction of your beam? So most of your beam isn't actually being rotated. I don't know. That's an interesting question. I don't know. Trapping flux seems to happen no matter what. So it's more the domains. Well, oh, the. Well, that might also trap a lot of domain walls and that, right? I haven't heard of any studies that purposely looked at that, but. But you're saying it's hard to get to the fast limit.
Yeah,
isn't that what you're saying?
Yeah. Because people have to make adjustment injunctions to this kind of experiment. And the reason is that you take an insulator, then the relaxation is still going on the speed.
Yeah.
Is it the grain of all the.
Well, no, but you mean the pinning of Wolsey's and Jess injunctions is the same as you would see? I mean, in this case?
No, I'm thinking of. How fast they have to go in order to have a substantial fraction of the vortices.
Well, I think the fluxes can be quite big, actually. At least at low temperatures, you've got enough thermal activation to allow the vortices to be swamped in it. But, I mean, I thought it could be a fraction of the time, wasn't
it? Usually it's compared to the.
Well, actually, I'm going to be showing you some images that were cooled in, like, nanotesla. So I consider those pretty small fields, right? You know, you really work to compensate all the residual fields, and you'll see, you get noticeable trapped vortices at nanotesla. And so, it's no problem trapping flux in these systems. But anyway, so the real point, so he sees this effect. It's interpreted in terms of P plus IP superconductivity. And shortly after Kapitolnik's results, there was a Fizrev letter that did a calculation of what you expect for a P plus IP superconductor and concluded that if you put in the parameters, you get, you'd expect a curve rotation angle of 230 nanoradians. Now, what Kapitolnik saw was 65 nanoradians, so that, that's less than a factor of 4 discrepancy, which I would consider nothing, because, these calculations are done for an isotropic gap. The gap isn't isotropic, and that, factors of 2 and 4 I wouldn't even worry about. I would say this is excellent agreement. Unfortunately, I went through this calculation, and you only get this result if you completely neglect the supercurrent. That is, this is the result you would get if you actually allowed this to be a superconductor with an orbital angular momentum of 1, and that gave rise to a nice field inside your superconductor, and it would cause this Kerr rotation. When you put in don't drop the supercurrent contribution, it gives you an exactly equal and opposite contribution, and you get identically 0.
Okay. How big is the
penetration depth? Penetration depth is about 1,800 angstroms in the, that's for the AB direction. It's much longer in the C-axis direction.
Is there any chance that the domain size could be comparable to the penetration depth, so that you don't have enough room to
That's possible, but even... on the other hand, that is something that you wouldn't expect to get. I mean, Kapitolnik is arguing that this is a number here, 65 nanoradians. If this was actually due to domain walls, first of all, it wouldn't actually be this big because as I say, this is actually, you get this number if you pretend your superconductor is like a ferromagnet. And every little angular momentum 1 gives you an analog of a moment, which gives you a Kerr rotation. So first of all, it wouldn't be this big. And secondly, if you're depending on domains, you better not be looking for anything universal, because through different cooldowns, different samples, it just doesn't happen. You don't have exactly the same domain distribution. So this is actually a new result. If you look back in the literature, actually from 1991, I believe Yip and Sols have a very detailed, lengthy and formal paper where they go through a long calculation a fair amount of generality for different order parameters and conclude that the Kerr rotation angle should be 0. I don't think it's received the attention it deserves because they never gave any simple explanation. It's like a lengthy calculation that if you plod through it, you'll eventually get 0 at the end. But in fact, so that's one nice thing that this Fizrev letter did. It sort of laid out the calculation in a way that you can easily see you get 0 if you put the supercurrents in. But Yip and Sols pointed out that you can get a non-zero contribution due to the collective modes if you have a P plus IP superconductor, but they're down from this measured result by 3 orders of magnitude. So here we have an experimental signature that you might say is positive, but it's 3 orders of magnitude bigger than what you'd expect for a chiral P-wave superconductor. And I'd say that's a problem. That means there's certainly some explanation of this experiment, but I wouldn't say it's P plus IP. Maybe there's some, ferromagnetic phase growing up at the same time. I don't know what, but I wouldn't attribute this to P plus IP with that kind of, with 3 orders of magnitude discrepancy.
How should I think about the reflection? Is it happening at the surface, or is it?
Oh, yeah. You're at optical frequency, so your light is going to penetrate to the optical depth, which I don't know exactly what it is for strontium ruthenate, but I would guess it's about 2,000 angstroms or so. So it's comparable probably to the penetration depth that your light penetrates.
In that region, could there be some spatial variation in the field? I mean, if it was short compared to the penetration depth.
Well, so this is, what they're reflecting off of is the AB surface, okay? So first of all, all these edge currents I talked about, flow around the edge of like a BC or an AC surface. You don't get supercurrents on the AB surface itself, So you don't really expect any, well, except through domain walls that actually intersect that surface, but and those would move around and give you a non-universal signal. So actually, you know, except for the problem with the magnitude, this would be interpreted that within your optical depth and the size of your beam, 25 microns, you're seeing basically a single domain. And if it was three orders of magnitude smaller, you know, that could be a confirmation of a collective mode.
So this estimate by Yakovenko is based on the domain wall?
No. So he doesn't have any domain walls. He has an infinite sample. That's why I say it should be identically zero. You know, I've communicated with Yakovenko. We disagree on this. I say the result should be zero. He gets 230 nanoradians. For the collective mode, as far as getting something that's three orders of magnitude, you don't need any domain walls in that. There's a collective mode that can operate in the bulk that carries the signature of chirality with it and gives you a small, tiny signal. Yeah. Okay, so now I want to move on to the experiments of Kirtley and Moeller. So Kirtley's technique is using scanning squid microscopy. So I just remind you that if you had your sample here was a nice single crystal, single domain, as I said, you'd have edge currents that flow around in a direction determined by the chirality of that domain. They're about within a coherence length of the surface. This is an AB surface here, C-axis direction coming out here, and then you'd have counter-flowing screening currents flowing within about the penetration depth of the surface. And so if you take and because of these counterflowing currents, there's a little magnetization localized within roughly the penetration depth of the surface, and you take a squid and you scan it over your surface, you should see the flux through the squid loop due to this magnetization. Okay?
And people have checked the surface is severe toxic.
Yeah, well, okay, actually, you know, it doesn't matter. You know, they're measuring fields, right? First of all, these are cleaved surfaces, so they should be good surfaces. But nevertheless, if for some reason, say, the first 100 layers of your sample didn't superconduct, which is pretty hard to imagine, right? Usually it would be the first 3 layers or something. Your fields, they're varying over the penetration depth, which is 2,000 angstroms. Within your sample, you're putting the squid like microns above your sample, and you're collecting flux over the area of your squid, which it turns out is 8 microns. So you see, these are localized in this way. They're going to come out over your sample and fan out, and you're collecting them over here in some big thing. It really doesn't matter what happens in the first 1,000 layers. Okay, yes, now that's a problem. If you had a lot of, not some micron, well, it depends. Actually, these squids are very sensitive. So,
It reduces it just because of the free components.
Yes, that's right. And if your domains get too small in the C-axis direction, like that is where, if this is your C-axis direction, you're talking about domains like this. Which, interestingly, remember your currents are actually caused by domains in the AB plane, but if you make domain walls like this, what it does is around your edges where you have currents flowing, they alternate then. And yes, that would mess up. But of course, that would mess up, every experiment looking for this broken time reversal symmetry, except from USR, because they're not sensitive to the direction of the field. Well, it would change the magnitudes maybe because you have canceling fields in that. MUSR would still see a good signal. Everything else would probably be strongly affected. Keep in mind, energetically, there isn't much reason to have domains, right? So, but it's true. If they get too small, you get into problem. So what does the squid see? So here's an AB surface. Here's your sample. This is the AB surface. There's epoxy around the sample. These are 3 different cool downs. These are images made by the scanning squid. So the grayscale here is showing, where you have more white, you have more flux. Where you have black, you have less flux. These white dots are trapped flux. The residual fields in all of these are of the order of a nanotesla. Some of them might be 3 nanotesla, some might be 1 nanotesla. But you see, you get, no matter how hard you work to try and get it into zero residual field, you always get some trapped flux. And what this is showing is just the details of the line scan as your squid goes across these white lines here, where so in this A scan, you know, there's no vortices nearby. You go through the B scan, it goes very close to the center of a vortex. That's this big peak here. The C scan, it gets close to two vortices, but not really on top of them, and that's those two peaks there. This is one of those scans just looked at in more detail, you know, with higher resolution, and also showing if you scan this whole square here, you see there's basically, you know, this is maybe zooming in looking for domain walls. I see that there's basically the flux through this whole square is zero to very high accuracy. You know, there's just very tiny fluctuations in the background flux, you know, which is attributed to noise in the squid. So here, you know, what should they have seen if the P plus IP, what does the P plus IP theory predict, okay? So here's the salt line down here is the data, where this is the superconductor, zero is its edge. This is outside the superconductor. You might see there's a tiny little shift in level here. That's 2 nanotesla. You know, there's 2 nanotesla outside the superconductor. The superconductor screens it. So there's a small level shift at the surface here, which you can model. This dotted line is just saying that you have a superconducting disk screening 2 nanotesla. That gives a pretty good fit to the data. And here's what they were looking for, where this goes up to 1. Okay? you know, so here's a signal that you could have reduced by a lot, you know, at least a couple orders of magnitude, and you should have been able to see it. And I should say, this is not just taking Matsumoto and Segrist's result and saying what you should see, because their result is for inside the bulk. As I just explained, you know, what you're actually measuring is you've got your squid device, you know, 3 microns above your surface. You've got a, you've got a surface, you've got a 3 microns above your surface, you've got an 8 micron pickup loop. You can do the modeling of how the field spread out, you know, due to the surface and the vacuum in between the surface and the pickup loop, and that gives you a reduced signal, and this is the reduced signal. You know, so we aren't talking about, I mean, that's, as I said, these squids are very sensitive. You know, they should be able to, I mean, vortices just, you know, picked up as huge signals, a single flux quantum. This is just some modeling of what they should have seen for different domain sizes. Of course, you do get into problems if the domain sizes get too small in any direction, but probably mostly the C direction will mess you up. This is just showing some data of Catherine Moeller's group, where it's a very similar measurement, except they use scanning Hall probe. The squid measures the flux directly. The scanning Hall probe measures the magnetic field directly. Their sample, this is just one square on the top of their sample that they completely scanned. But their sample was prepared where they used focused ion beam to drill these 1 micron diameter holes, 1 micron deep, 20 microns spaced on their sample, in the hopes that you would see little supercurrents or little fields associated with the edges of these holes. Okay, so that's what their sample looks like. This is what their Hall bar picks up. This is what it picks up on a more magnified scale. Those dots there are trapped vortices. And other than that, there's absolutely no signature. You can't even tell, you know, this is a one-to-one mapping here. You can't even tell where those holes are, right? There's no signature of anything happening around those holes. So again, if you compare this and put in pretty conservative estimates for your noise level from these various experiments compared to the predicted values, you know, modeled through, you know, through the propagation up to your pickup loops or devices, you see, you know, you have somewhere between 1 and 2 orders of magnitude unless the domains get very small. And in this case, it helps a lot that the Hall bar is a smaller device, and so it should have been able to see even fairly small domains, whereas the squid's quite a large device. You know, it can't resolve the smaller domains. But I'd say, you know, this is, you know, my interpretation of this data, well, is if you have a P plus IP superconductor there, all you could possibly have it couldn't really be your whole component of superconductivity. I mean, this fact you have a superconductor there. If your signal is down by two orders of magnitude, it's basically saying that any P plus IP component is only a tiny part of your superconductivity. Because of course in these, in crystal fields and that, you may not have, there can be a lot of anisotropy effects and that sort of cloud the issue of the symmetry. But, anyways, you can think of things that reduce the signal, but it doesn't get you two orders of magnitude. So I've left sort of the most complicated and controversial experiment, as far as I'm concerned, to the last. It doesn't take me that long to explain it, but it probably requires 5 or 7 minutes. Should I go ahead and talk about it? But, okay. So these are Van Harlingen's phase-sensitive measurements. They're some of the latest measurements, published in Science, which are, I talked about the earlier phase-sensitive measurements briefly just to say they were checking the parity. So what Van Harlingen has done here is, that was looking at a SQUID device, two Josephson junctions. This is using a single Josephson junction measurement. And he's going to argue that his data is actually testing the chirality of the order parameter. So, this is quite a different interpretation than most single Josephson junction devices, and it's worth a little bit of discussion. So first of all, if you had an ideal single Josephson junction, you apply a field parallel to that junction so that the junction encloses a flux. Ideally, what you expect is a Fraunhofer pattern. So, you may recognize, that's that pattern where you get these nice oscillations with a big envelope function. What Van Harlingen sees is what he calls Fraunhofer type patterns, and he compares these to the type of patterns you would get from domains of PX plus or minus IPY, which we've talked about. And now he says to get a better fit to his data, he also has to include domains of PY plus or minus IPX. And you see, I'll come back to this point because on the next transparency, this will be made clear why this is such an important feature. It's the feature that allows him to say he's testing the chirality and not just the parity. And it's also a feature that I find very puzzling, but we'll discuss that on the next transparency. So they also see, in addition to this modeling, in order to really describe their data, they see a lot of dynamics, which they attribute to the dynamics of the domain walls. They say they're moving around on time, as you scan the field in one direction or the other, and they're also relatively small, about 1 micron. Okay, so here's his analysis of the data. Now, these little circles here are supposed to represent the P plus IP or P minus IP because, see, the colors are rotating in opposite senses. Now, I find it a lot easier to just think in terms of your two P waves. Say, if you've got PX plus IPY, say you've got a plus sign, minus sign here, an I, and a minus I here. And then you can have a domain wall where I put a minus sign there, so now I get a minus I and an I, but a plus or minus. And so if I'm looking at the corner of my sample and I have another domain wall here, that means I put a minus I and an I and a plus or minus. And you make this interesting observation that, see here, you've got a phase shift of pi, right, for tunneling in. If you compare a tunnel junction here to here, you see that the order parameter has changed by pi, right, from minus I to I. You tunnel on this side here, and you notice that there's no phase shift. That's delta equals zero. Even though you've got a domain wall, but it's not sensitive for that direction of tunneling. So that's these results, delta equals pi, delta equals zero. You lay down any pattern of the domain walls we've been talking about, and that's all you get, either pis or zeros. Okay. And when he models them, this is basically if you have zero, then you're just going to get a Fraunhofer pattern, right? There's no phase shift. If you have pis and you model them in some random distribution over the size of his junction, about 10 domains of random size, he gets some spectra of which this is supposed to be a typical simulation. Here's his data. He would say this looks like a Fraunhofer pattern. This looks roughly like the simulation. But he sees other patterns, which he says doesn't fit into pi or zero. But if you model this now, instead of just allowing these type of domains, how about if px plus ipy goes to ipx, you know, either minus py or plus py, okay? So the point is, by allowing, in particular, to get a pi over 2 junction, you have to just multiply this by I, because that's what's going to give you this phase change. So if you go I px, and that gets, so that gives you the minus sign. Okay, and you do this analysis, and you find that allowing those type of domains, you get minus pi over 2 and plus pi over 2. So when you simulate this, this is going to give you a different pattern, right, because you've got a different phase shift. Now, what I say is, you know, why would a superconductor ever have a domain wall between taking its order parameter and then rotating everything by an overall phase? You know, and if it did that, what would ever pin that? You know, what's going to pin a domain wall that all it's caused is a constant rotation of the overall phase? I mean, first of all, it costs you energy, you know, to rotate like that, and it can just undo it. You know, there isn't any, you know, I mean, these two states have a different chirality. You know, you don't just unwind one of these into the other one. But if you're just causing an overall phase shift, you know, why make it I? You could make it I over 2, you know, you could make it any angle.
It would give you a current.
It gives you a current, costs you energy. So I don't know. You know, that's, I'm puzzled by this. You know, like, of course, if you say the system does this, and that it only does this, like it only does I rotations, no other rotations, then no question that is connected to the chirality, because, you know, somehow that I was coming in there from the chirality. But anyways, he says that, you know, this gives him the best modeling of his data and directly ties to the chirality. I find it quite confusing as to why. And on top of that, he simulates that if you take some configuration of domains and you just move one domain wall, so that's all he's done here, he moved one domain wall, you change from a signal like this blue one to this red one, where if you look at the change in the two signals, you get this green curve. And he's saying that as he sweeps out one field and then goes back, you know, sweeping the field in another direction, or just, you know, waiting half an hour and doing the same run again, whatever, the patterns change over time in a way that can be modeled by moving domain walls, okay? And I think, you know, to just summarize what he sees, it's perhaps best to take his own words. These are the conclusions of the science paper. He says that what they observe is complicated modulations, characteristic of interference between regions with different phase and size. It's one thing they see. They see distinctly different behavior in different crystals, and even in different junctions on the same crystal. They see asymmetry with respect to field direction. They see abrupt jumps in the critical current. They see telegraph switching noise. So that's this thing changing with time. So these are all characteristics of their signal, and they argue that all these characteristics are captured by modeling them with these four types of domains. I think, you know, you can agree that's a pretty complicated, you know, I mean, he's obviously seeing a lot of structure there. I think he has tried to rule out things like trapped flux that, you know, could attribute, that you could account for all of these signals together, but certainly trapped flux could account for some of those signals. And I guess, you know, it begs the question, is this consistent with some other picture? You know, so maybe you can fit it into the P plus IP picture, although I am concerned about these other domains and that. So you see, you know, if you look at the various experiments that have tried to address the chirality, you know, I've made my arguments as to why I think, you know, none of them are clear-cut. They all have major, you know, discrepancies or puzzles, in this case about the domain walls and the Kerr effect. It's about the size of the effect, and the mu SR, it's about the direction of the fields and the lack of any fields due to the muons themselves. And so I'd say every experiment that claims to show chiral superconductivity is not really giving good agreement with P plus IP. So just summarizing, what I would say is I do think there's very strong evidence that strontium ruthenate is an unconventional, that is non-S-wave superconductor. Probably it's triplet pairing, although, you know, people do argue about this because of the new experiments really make it complicated to interpret simply in terms of a triplet, but it's also complicated to interpret in terms of a singlet. So we probably just need more data there and more ideas. There is evidence for some kind of time reversal symmetry breaking from USR and the polar Kerr effect, but neither of these really matches on to what you expect from the theory. There's no evidence of spontaneous supercurrents at edges or domain boundaries, and this is problematic for a chiral superconductivity. I'd say one of the Josephson junction experiments does point to odd parity, could be P wave, could be F wave, and the other is interpreted in terms of these domains, and I think it remains to be understood what these domains, the second set of domains, actually mean. So I think, you know, what I would say we need is more experiments. Got some ideas here, you know, of other probes that could look for edge currents. Certainly more detailed MUSR I measured. I mentioned Moeller's group has now designed an even smaller Hall probe that will be more sensitive and may put even lower limits on these edge currents. For the theory, certainly, you know, there is this polar Kerr effect which needs some explanation. There's certainly something causing it. One should analyze the existing data for other possible order parameters. We need proposals for more definitive experiments. And there are real materials issues that, you know, Sigrist and others have addressed to some extent, but you always have to keep them in mind that we actually, you know, this is a material that actually has three Fermi surfaces. There's noticeable crystal anisotropy. And if the coherence length in the C-axis direction is really as long as they say it is, I think people have to start worrying about pairing in the C-axis direction, although I'm not sure whether the measurement of the coherence length there is reliable. That's another, that may be another way of interpreting the data. Okay, so. So what do you think? So who thinks it's P plus IP?
The three Fermi surfaces, are they equivalent?
No, actually, I think, here's a nice picture of the beautiful, they're beautiful Fermi surfaces, aren't they? Anyways, no, it's you get these two, these are hole pockets here in the corners, and then there's two electron Fermi surfaces where actually these white ones and orange ones basically come from bands which to a first approximation in the Brillouin zone looked like this, and then they hybridized and gave this. So they were sort of quasi 1D bands. And then there's a true 2D band here that is the yellow one that fits in between. As you can see, there's not a lot of dispersion in the C-axis direction. You know, that's saying it's pretty two-dimensional.
So have people done the Huston Alpha?
Actually, that I don't know. Have you heard of any? Yeah, actually, we just heard some amazing results of de Huston-Alphen on YBCO in the underdoped.
Well, it's actually polar
oscillations. Okay. Yeah, but they see a Fermi surface in the pseudo-gap phase of the underdoped these are Louis' results, right? What? Oh, Well, so this is basically... saying, you know, whatever novel state we have there has... anyways, that's a different topic.
But no, there is a lot of data of this from Cambridge group.
Of what, like de Huston-Alphen, or...?
That sort of...
Yeah.
Sort of power probe, yeah.
Right.
And there used to be a controversy between the surface ones.
Right. So does this picture of the Fermi surfaces, people believe that? Yeah.
So I thought that is, in fact, the experimental data.
Can you then look as you go through TC to see which bits disappear?
I know what people believe. I don't know what evidence it's based on, is that this 2D sheet... The gamma sheet is believed to be, you know, the primary carrier of the superconductivity. Yes, the yellow one. And the other ones, superconductivity is induced once it starts in the... Yes. Yeah. But I don't know, you know, what data, you know, leads to that or whether it's calculations.
These aren't
Actually, one thing I should say is, all these experiments I talked about, are very demanding experiments. I mean, it's not just the temperature. It's like if you read about the NMR, it took them like, I don't know what it was, 6 or 8 years to be able to put the field in the other direction and get an NMR signal. You know, it wasn't that. They weren't trying. There's a lot of, in the polar care effect, it was, Kapitulnik's group developing for years the sensitivity of this technique and that. So, they're all very challenging experiments, and I believe all the experiments are telling us something. It's just a matter of being careful about exactly what they're telling you.
Thank you.